Thank you all for coming. Can you hear me all right? It's good? Okay. So, yeah, as my title says, I'm going to talk optimization during the building of the fundamental model. So, some things about how to estimate parameters, and then many of you who do optimization will start with some kind of model or some kind of equations to describe your system, and then do some optimization using the model. But I'm going to talk about making the model in the first place, mostly. So what I'm going to talk about is modeling and models and some ideas about where our models come from. I'm going to present a case study on nylon 6/6 polymerization. So the polymerization is the good thing to make nylon, but if you, while you're making nylon, if you keep it in a chemical reactor at too high of a temperature for too long with too little moisture in there, then you get some degradation reactions that are unfortunate and they lead to bad product properties. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. And so I'll talk about the process of building that model and some of the optimization tools that I use. And in particular, I'm going to talk about estimating parameters. Sometimes when chemical engineers develop models, we have vivid imaginations and we have nice ways of describing systems and we do material and energy balances, and we end up with models that have too many parameters to estimate given the data that we can generate, because the data are really quite expensive. And so if you have too many models, then this is a technique for deciding which parameters you should estimate and which ones you should leave alone based on some prior knowledge that you might have about them. So first of all, we'll rank all the parameters from the most estimable to the least estimable, so the ones you really should estimate to the ones it's okay if you don't bother estimating them. And then the next part is then deciding, once you have that list, how many parameters from the list you should estimate. Should you estimate 10? Should you estimate 15? How do you decide? And then a little bit also about experimental design. So after you've done this work, if you decide, well, my model's still not good enough, I need some better parameter values, which kinds of experiments should I spend my money on so that I can get a better model? And then eventually someone will use the model for something. So first I'll talk a little bit about chemical companies. And the objective of chemical companies is... Okay, this is bad. I think I'm going to take off my jacket. If I put this up here, then maybe I'll stop making those bad noises. So the objective of chemical companies is to make money. And the way that they make money is by products with the targeted properties that people want to buy. If you have some kind of chemical factory or process, to select operating targets and strategies to make these products in the most economical way possible. Chemical engineers, if they develop some new kind of product in a lab, then they want it to bring it to full-scale production and to market as quickly as possible. And while they're doing this, they want to gain some fundamental kinds of chemical engineering knowledge about what they're doing so that they can solve problems in the future. So they also want to generate some knowledge. And the models that I'm talking about developing, they're the kind of models that companies can, after they're built, use to design and test automatic control schemes, optimize grade changeover policies. So in some chemical processes, let's imagine if we're making polyethylene, which is the cheapest kind of plastic, one day the company may be making the kind of polyethylene that's in garbage bags, and then the next day they'll be switching over to make the kind of polyethylene that's in margarine tubs that has different properties, and they want to know how to get from one type of plastic to the other as quickly as possible without making off-specification material and to make the most money and generate the least amount of waste. So that's what I mean about grade changes. If we're going to build a new kind of plant, a new plant, then we can use our model for designing the new one to behave better than the old one based on the information in our models. If we're going to conduct some kind of expensive experimental campaign, we can pick the experiments that will generate the most information for us so that we can make best decisions in the future. And models, so these green ones here are all things that once you've built the mathematical models that I'm talking about, once you've built them, then people can use the models in those kinds of studies. In addition, models are really wonderful when things do go wrong sometimes, so to test some theories about what might have gone wrong if you have some product quality upsets and you're not making the making products with the desired qualities that you want, and also to capture, store, and distribute knowledge. So if I have some nice fundamental model equations, and I'll talk more about the fundamental models in a moment, if I have some nice equations that capture my knowledge about the physics and chemistry of a chemical process, well then, and I've, you know, I've got a PhD and I've studied this and worked on this process for many years, I could give my model to a new engineer, and then that person would be able to use the knowledge in my model to make some predictions. I'm going to talk about fundamental models, not empirical models. So you can see here I have two columns. So fundamental models require detailed scientific knowledge. So we have to have some stories and some mythology about what's going on inside of the chemical reactors that we're interested in. And if we change the temperatures and the other kinds of conditions inside of this polymerization reactor or chemical reactor, then we can use the model to predict what's going to happen to the product qualities. If we're making polymer, does the molecular weight go up? Does it go down? What will happen to the color of the product? These kinds of things that we can predict. If you have a fundamental model with lots of science in it, then you can use that model to apply to new kinds of situations that you might not have encountered when you were building the model. And these models are really wonderful for summarizing and disseminating the knowledge that went into them. Empirical models are also really useful, and these are more where you don't need very much scientific knowledge ahead of time, and they mostly rely on statistics and the data that you have. And so they require a lot of statistical skill, a lot of data, but less time and effort and less knowledge to build them. If you have these empirical models, they're good if you're just going to interpolate within the data set that you have, but if you want to do some extrapolations, then they may not be very reliable, and they can only really be used for the system that you've collected the data on, but the fundamental models can apply to new situations that you might not have been thinking about. So you might think that I've been sort of complaining about empirical models. Empirical models just generated from data, so this would be like the simplest idea would be just fitting a straight line to some data. Those kinds of models are really helpful when exploring the kinds of phenomena and variables to include in a complicated model. So just a few more words about the models that I developed. First of all, how many of you are different kinds of engineers in the model, in the audience? Any engineers? One, two, three, okay, four. Mathematicians? Okay, do we have any physicists and other kinds of scientists? Okay, so we have a variety of people. What about you folks at the back who didn't put your hand up? Computer scientists, okay. So I hope that this talk will be interesting to all of you. So chemical engineers, we spend lots of time learning about heat transfer and mass transfer and fluid mechanics and thermodynamics and rates of chemical reactions. And we have equations that go with all of these kinds of things that we study. And the fun part of developing a mechanistic model is making some assumptions and then writing down all of the mathematical equations that go along with those phenomena that are going to predict what you have going on inside of your chemical process. So once you derive all of those equations, and I'll show you some equations in a little while, then they're usually nonlinear, and sometimes they're differential equations, sometimes they're partial differential equations, sometimes just algebraic equations. It depends what you're modeling and what you care about. But there's usually no analytical solution, so you have to be able to solve them numerically using, there are many parameters in there that might be physical properties, rates of chemical reaction rate constants, activation energies, those kinds of things. So you have to have some values for these parameters to even be able to solve the model equation. So then we can solve the model. Some of the if other people have modeled the sorts of things that you're modeling before, well, then maybe you can go to the library or go online and get values for some of the parameters from the literature. I'm assuming that you have some experimental data as well, maybe some new experiments or maybe some old experiments that someone else conducted, and then you can use the data from those experiments, and we're going to estimate some model parameters. And so I'm going to talk about some of the optimization that's involved in this fit, this data fitting exercise. Then after you fit the data to the model, then you want to see can the model predictions match the data very well. So you test the model fit. If you're not satisfied, then maybe you have to get some new equations and make some new assumptions about the underlying physics and chemistry. Or maybe you can conduct some more experiments to get better values of the parameters. And then and revise the model structure or not. And maybe you save some, if you're a good person, then maybe you save some experiments that you didn't use for fitting and try to predict those so you can see whether your model can just fit the data or whether it can predict new data very well or at all. And then finally, someone ought to use the model at the end, because if no one uses it, maybe it was an interesting academic exercise, but you haven't helped chemical companies make money, which is what they're interested in. So I'm going to talk about some work from two of my PhD students. Hadis Karimi is a current PhD student. Mark Schaefer is a PhD student from several years ago. And I'm going to talk about modeling thermal degradation in nylon 6,6. So nylon 6,6 is a kind of nylon. It's the nylon that's in, let's say, nylon stockings or nylon if you have a nylon tent. And the just a little bit of chemistry. The main chemical reaction that happens inside of industrial nylon polymerization reactors is this is a carboxylic acid end here, and this is an amine end, and the desired chemical reaction that we want to have is these two ends to find each other. We make an amide link, which is what that guy is called there, and some water comes off. And so we take a bunch of short molecules and we join them together with these amide links to make long molecules, and then those long molecules have good physical properties when you use them to make fibers, let's say, for nylon stockings or to put into a tent. If you want to make high molecular weights, you want very long chemical chains, then you have to take out the water, because this arrow here shows that the reaction goes in the forward direction. It can also go backwards. So if there's water hanging around, it can cause the reaction to go backwards, and then you won't get very high molecular weight. You have to take out the water. But if you take out too much water, then we can get some undesirable degradation reactions. And there's a whole set of, in this model, we consider the main polyamidation reaction shown there, and then an additional 10 reactions that are related to thermal degradation. So I won't show you there. So I'll show you these. So here's a picture right here with some nylon fibers, so maybe you can make some nylon thread. And the reason that no one wants these thermal degradation reactions to occur is because they change what's on the ends of the polymer molecules, and whatever chemical species are on the ends of the molecules influence what happens when you try to dye the nylon a certain color. So if you are in the business of making carpet, and then you get the wrong things on the end, and then maybe the carpet is supposed to be the color of the green of those chairs, and then you had some degradation reactions, maybe it will be some kind of color that's not quite like that, and then you can't sell the next batch of carpet to people. So it's quite practical why you don't want these degradation reactions. Also, when these chemical reactions that I'm not going to show you, they have some gaseous materials that can come off of the nylon, and some branching reactions. So instead of just getting long polymer chains that look like spaghetti, you can get little branches off the sides, so they look like twigs, and then if you're trying to spin those into fibers to make into thread, it doesn't work very well, and you have to shut down your spinning machine. So it can be very bad to have degradation reactions. Okay, so here is a schematic diagram of a reactor for making nylon, and so you can see this gray part here is liquid. And the blue things, that's amine ends, carboxyl ends, amide links, and water. If everything was good, all that we would have in the reacting mixture would be those things, amide ends, carboxyl ends, links, and water. But since we have these degradation reactions going on, we have some other things going in here. We have some stabilized ends, different kinds of shift base ends, these some different kinds of links that lead to branching. Also, in the there's a head space, so there's gas above the liquid inside the reactor. And so normally what should be in there is just nitrogen and water. If only we had just our desired reaction, that's what would happen. But since we have the degradation reactions, we can get something called cyclopentanone, we can get carbon dioxide, and we can get ammonia coming off. So there's a, I have some pictures later if you want to see them of the real physical reactor system, but it's better, I think, in this diagram because you can get an idea of what's going on. So we did some, we got some money from DuPont Canada and did a lot of reactions and experiments at Queen's, where what we did is we took mixtures of steam, which is just water, and nitrogen. We mixed them together, heated them up to a desired temperature, sent them down this tube, and then had bubbles of steam and nitrogen that would bubble up through this reacting mixture. And water that was generated here in the liquid would go from the liquid phase into the bubbles and then come up into the headspace. And also some of the cyclopentanone that gets generated here in the liquid would end up in the bubbles and then go up in the headspace. So you can see these species would end up in the bubbles. And then we take gas sample measurements off the top of the reactor so we can measure how much carbon dioxide we're making, how much ammonia we're making, and how much cyclopentanone we're making. And also, at various times, we can grab polymer samples out of this vessel, and we can measure the amine end concentrations, carboxyl end concentrations, and BHMT is a certain kind of branching species that we can measure. So we don't want BHMT, but we can measure it. We don't want these things, we can measure them. And then that gives us an idea about the rates of different kinds of reactions. So here's some experiments that we did, and all of this, all of these experiments were designed so that we could build a model so that DuPont could use it to make predictions on their real chemical plants. And so you can see we had some experiments done at relatively low temperatures, around so low for a nylon polymerization reactor in the part of the process we're interested in is around 270 or 280 degrees Celsius. We had some low temperature runs. We had some higher ones up around 290, some middle ones. And we also adjusted, I showed you where we mixed the nitrogen and the steam coming in. We did some where the partial pressure of water is low. So this one here is mostly nitrogen and a little bit of steam, sort of four parts nitrogen to one part steam, and we did some other ones where we just put in pure steam and different things in between. And we would run these experiments for different amounts of time, between 2 and about 10 hours, and we would capture gas samples off at various times and liquid polymer samples off at various times, and then we would take them away and analyze them. And that's the kind of data then are the results of those experiments that we want to fit. So if we look at our model that we wrote based on our ideas about the chemistry, you can see that we ended up with 14 differential equations. They're all of the sort of form of, this one's about amine ends, so this is about the constant accumulation of amine ends in the reacting mixture is equal to the rate of generation of amine ends by different different kinds of reactions and minus the consumption of amine ends. And so here we have water. Water can be generated and consumed by a bunch of different reactions. And this one, this term here is about water escaping from the liquid phase into the bubbles. So there's a mass transfer term and so on. And so we have 14 differential equations. I don't show them all to you. These rate expressions, I'll show you some of them. So we have 11 different chemical reactions. And each of those chemical reactions, we have some ideas of what causes those reactions. So we say reaction 11 is proportional to the concentration of these shift bases in the reacting mixture and the cyclopentanone in the reacting mixture. And then there's this kinetic rate coefficient out in front. And the value of this K11 depends on temperature. And so we have all these rate expressions that we can substitute into the differential equations. And then if we look at these K values here, which are there on the next page, that's where our model parameters come from. So we have 26 of these unknown model parameters based on this, the chemistry that we think is going on inside of this vessel. And so this is what's called an Arrhenius expression. So this is the value of the rate constant at a certain temperature, T naught, that we're interested in. And then this thing here is an activation energy. That's about how the temperature influences the rate of different chemical reactions. So for each reaction we have sort of a K parameter and an E parameter. Then we have some equilibrium parameters that have some K values and enthalpy parameters. And then this thing here is called a mass transfer coefficient, which is like a heat transfer coefficient in your model. So you can see we've got a driving force and a transfer coefficient. So we have 26, I'm not showing you all of them, we have 26 of these kinds of parameters that if we substituted everything in would appear at different places in our differential equation models. And if we're going to make predictions from our models, it's not so hard to solve these nonlinear differential equations. What's hard is to get good values, good numerical values of these parameters so that predictions from the model will match up with what really happens in the process. Also, when we start these experiments, we got some nylon 6-6 pellets from DuPont. We put them inside the reactor. We melted them, got them all mixed up, heated them up to the desired temperature, and then we started our experiments. But some of the initial concentrations of the degraded end groups and some of the branching points, we don't really know what they are. So there are 5 initial concentrations, so initial values of state variables that are unknown for each different run, and they may be different from run to run. So that, and we had 6 experimental runs that I showed you, so that means we have 30 unknown initial concentrations, 26 model parameters. We need 56 numerical values so that we can run some simulations, and if we get good values, then maybe we'll get good predictions if our mechanism is right. Okay, so we need some initial values from somewhere. Fortunately, my PhD students, so for this latest study we've been doing, my PhD students, who Keith, who's sitting in the audience, he's going to talk next. Keith was the co-supervisor of Mark Schaefer. And so Mark had done some prior modeling work, and we had some reasonably good ideas about values or reasonable ranges of some of the parameters from Mark's work. Another student, Saeed Verziri, had done some parameter estimation on a different kind of nylon, nylon 6-12. But if you build a model for nylon 6-12 production, some of the parameters that I showed in the nylon 6-6 model also appear in the nylon 6-12 model, and they should be numerically the same. So we could get reasonable values, so sort of ranges from Saeed's work about what would be reasonable values of those. Some of the unknown initial values for degraded things, degraded end groups and branching points, we just set all of those to zero as our initial guess, saying, well, we hope at the beginning that the polymer that DuPont gave us to start out with was in pretty good shape and wasn't too degraded when they were making it, and that we didn't do too many bad things to it while we were putting it in our reaction vessel and heating it up. We know zero isn't quite right, but we'll start there as our initial guess. And then we have these parameters here that we really had a very limited ideas about. And so those ones had quite large uncertainties. Okay, so that's where we were. We made up some values, and then we start solving model equations. And so if you want to estimate the parameters, then you use a nonlinear least squares. And here's the kind of objective function that we have. So remember I said the aiming ends are measured. So we take the measurement, we subtract off the model prediction. We've got some kind of scaling factor that's about the uncertainty of the measured concentrations of amine ends. And so we add up all of the deviations between the model predictions and the data for the amine ends from all of the experiments. Same thing for the carboxyl ends and these BHMT branch points. And then we also have terms related to model predictions for how much carbon dioxide is being generated, and then physical measurements of how much is being generated, and then we have the other gases. We add them all up. We've got these nice scaling factors, so all of these terms are dimensionless, and that's the objective function we're trying to optimize. And all we have to do is find values for the 56 parameters and initial conditions to minimize this objective function, and then we're in good shape. Okay? So that's the idea. The optimizer that we used, we did this modeling work in MATLAB, and we used LSQ Nonlin, which is not a very sophisticated kind of optimization tool, but it worked well enough for us. We used generated numerical Jacobians. One thing I'd like to say is tolerance selection is really important. So when you are perturbing values of the parameters to find out what their influence is, you want to make sure that you're solving the differential equations really quite precisely, so that when you get the terms in the Jacobian, that you're not just lost in the numerical noise from trying to solve the differential equations over and over again. So you have to do big enough parameter perturbations to get the Jacobian so that you get beyond the numerical noise. Otherwise, you have some bad problems. And doing this parameter estimation, it was a kind of sequential approach where we would get the initial parameter values, simulate all of the data. The optimizer would then get some new values, better values for the parameters. We put those in, solve all the differential equations, and we do it again and again and again until it converges. Okay, so the problem is if you try to do this, given the data, even though we had a lot of really nice data, we had so many parameters that the parameter estimation problem is difficult. And if we don't get good parameter values, we'll get lousy model predictions and DuPont won't be able to use the model. So we had too many parameters for the available data. Some of the parameters have little influence. So if you adjust them around and then look at the model predictions, they really don't influence the predictions very much. So you can't estimate those parameters well. But that's all right because, you know, any old value within a reasonable range for those ones will do and you don't need to estimate them. Influence of the parameters is highly correlated. So you can have pairs of parameters that you move together and you can get almost the same predictions so you can have multiple sets of parameters that give nearly the same model predictions, which makes this estimation, this inverse kind of problem, really hard. Also, we have problems with some local minima that appear. It's not convex. Okay. So the way we went about trying to figure out which parameters to estimate is a two-step process. First of all, we ranked the parameters using something called estimability analysis. And to do this, we need a sensitivity matrix. I'll show you what that looks like in a minute. And in this algorithm, there's an orthogonalization step that accounts for correlation between the influences of the various parameters. So we can look after the correlated effects part. And then after we get the parameters ranked from most estimable to least estimable based on the type of experiments we have, then the next step is to decide how many parameters to estimate from the list. Should we estimate the top 10 or the top 40, or can we estimate all 56 of them? So this work was developed by another PhD student of mine, Roy Wu, who did some nice theoretical work on statistical work on this critical ratio that he uses. And you can calculate values of the critical ratio just using the objective function for parameter estimation. And once you compute this critical ratio, the number of parameters to estimate with the smallest value of this ratio, you say, aha, that's the number of parameters I should estimate. So I'll show you that in a minute. Okay, so we're going to talk about the ranking algorithm first. What we want to do is select only the most important parameters for estimation. And the ones that we should really estimate are the ones that either have a big influence or maybe they have a large amount of uncertainty. If you have a parameter that doesn't influence the predictions very much, well, who cares? We don't need to estimate that one. Or if we have a parameter that we already know a lot about, we know that this one is 7 plus or minus 0.1, we say, well, maybe we don't need to estimate that. We can just put in 7 and use it, and we should focus our attention on the other parameters. And the ones that we don't estimate, we're going to just leave them at their initial values. And again, I talked about this ranking depends on which ones are influential, correlation among the parameters, and how uncertain or certain the initial guesses are. So here's our sensitivity matrix that we construct. We call it Z. And in the sensitivity matrix, you can see, so these Ys are model predictions, and we have all of those different kinds of concentration variables collected at different times from different runs. And so there's one row in this Z matrix for each that corresponds to each data value that we're going to try to predict so that we can fit it. So if we have, I don't know, maybe we had, I don't know, 200 data values, so that we would have 200 rows in this matrix. And there's one column for each parameter that we're thinking about estimating. So there would be 56 columns in this matrix. And so you can see they're just partial derivatives of when you make an adjustment to parameter 1, how does that influence predicted response 1? And one thing that we have to do is we have to do scaling because the different response variables have different kinds of units. the measure variables have different kinds of units, and the parameters have different kinds of units. So what we do is each one of these elements, we scale by the uncertainty, the initial uncertainty in the parameter value, and so that S will have the same units as the parameters, and we also scale by the measurement uncertainty for the different kinds of responses that are measured. So if we did an experimental run one day, and then we tried to do it again the next day, we wouldn't get exactly the same measured values because of all the randomness in the system. So we get this matrix with all of these sensitivity coefficients. We scale them appropriately, and if anyone's interested, you can have this that wants to do similar things, then there's some references at the bottom that explain how to do this. So after we've got this sensitivity matrix Z, what we want to do is we want to select, we look at the columns, and so if we look at the columns in this Z matrix, the columns that tend to have either big positive or big negative numbers correspond to parameters that have a large influence on the model predictions. So what we want to do is take the sum of squares of each column, and then the column with the biggest sum of squares, that is the most estimable parameter. That's the one that we pick out to estimate. So after we do that, then we have to worry about, we couldn't just pick the second biggest column to correspond to the second most estimable parameter, because maybe the influence of the two parameters that we would pick would be highly correlated with each other. And so that's why we do this kind of least squares, I can't think of the word right now. This least squared fitting, where we're going to fit the sensitivity matrix using the information in the column that we selected. And then we can calculate a residual. So we take our sensitivity matrix, we subtract off the part of the sensitivity matrix, we subtract out the part that was correlated with the parameter that we picked, and then we have this nice orthogonal, we have what's orthogonal to the column that we picked, and then the biggest column in R1 is our second most estimable parameter. And so we go along and we add more and more columns to these X matrices, and we rank from most estimable to least estimable. Okay. To do this, so we find the first most estimable, second, third, and so on. So one problem with this approach, if you're being critical, is that the values that you get depend on what you assumed to be the initial parameter guesses, because all of those partial derivatives, the values that you get for them, depend on the values of the initial guesses for the parameters. And also, they depend on the assumptions that you made about scaling, so those S values that I was talking about. And so if you use slightly different S values or different initial guesses, you might get a different ranking. And so you might want to try this over a few times just to see how robust it is for your problem. Another issue is that selecting one parameter at a time can be suboptimal. So if we pick the most estimable parameter and then we say, okay, we're going to think about that one, and then we're going to pick the second one given that we selected the first one, we might get a slightly different answer if we decided what are the best two parameters to estimate and then what are the best three to estimate. But if you think about, you know, what are the best three to estimate, then you have 56 choose three different combinations to think of, and by the time you get to like 56 choose 20 different combinations of parameters that you could think about picking out the best ones, 56 choose 20 gets to be a really big number. So even if this is suboptimal, it's a good idea to just do them one at a time. Okay, so we have our ranked list. I'm only showing you the first four parameters on the ranked list because no one wants to see a table with 56 things in it. You can see they have different kinds of units, different parameter values. To do this, we had to specify some initial values and some uncertainties or scaling factors. Now we have our list, and we have to decide how many parameters will we estimate. And the idea is to get the model, pick the number of parameters to estimate so that our model will give the best possible predictions at the end. If we estimate too many parameters, you might think, ooh, that's a bad idea. We're going to run into some numerical problems when we try estimating the parameters. Also, maybe we'll just be fitting the noise in the data, and we won't get very good predictions. If we try to estimate too few parameters, then all of the other parameters that we're not estimating will be fixed at the wrong values, and we'll get some bias in our model predictions, and so that's bad. So we have to find the right trade-off between bias and variance. Here's a picture of the objective function J for this nylon 6-6 degradation model. As you estimate more and more parameters from the top of the ranked list, And so if you estimate no parameters at all, just with our initial guesses, you get some number around 2,000, and then it goes down as you estimate more and more parameters. When you get to 44 parameters, the conditioning of this parameter estimation problem becomes horrible, and then you really can't estimate anymore. After that, you get all kinds of error messages and things. And using this method of this model selection technique of how many parameters to estimate from the rank list, we find, well, you can estimate 44, but it's better to estimate only 43. So we'll talk about how that works. So I'm not sure how many of you here love and use statistics? I know you do because you do stochastic things. Anyone else? So if I say non-central F distribution, is anyone in the room going to get excited? Okay, no, good, that tells me something. So, mean square error, we're interested in good model predictions. We want the predictions to be close to what the prediction should be if the parameter values were perfect. So we're gonna assume the model equations are themselves are perfect. And if we only had good values for the parameters, then we would be so happy with our predictions. But the parameter values, they're not perfect, and so we're gonna get some errors. And so mean square error is you take deviations between the model predictions and what you would get if you had the true values for the parameters, and you add those all up and you square them and you make sure they're properly scaled, and then that would be the total mean square error. And this mean square error, it's got two parts. It's got, you can think of it as having squared bias and also variance. If you estimate a large number of parameters with not very good data, then there's lots of uncertainty in all the parameters, and then that uncertainty in the parameters turns out lots of uncertainty in the model predictions, and so that's the variance part. But if you estimate too few parameters and you fix some of the parameters at bad values, then you get bias, and so that's the bias squared part. So if we maximize or if we minimize the mean square error, then that will give us the right balance and the right number of parameters to estimate. And so my PhD student Roy said, well, if we estimate more and more parameters, so if we estimate all p parameters, we're going to have big variance. And if we look at how much the variance goes down because we estimated only a few parameters, only k, so this is the variance reduction by estimating fewer parameters, we hope that that's good. But if we only estimate k parameters, then we're going to get bias because we fixed some parameters at the wrong value. And so if this ratio is less than 1, then it's better to estimate just, let's say, 17 parameters, if k is 17 and that's less than 1, rather than all 56. If this ratio is bigger than 1, then it's not a good idea. We should just try to estimate all 56. The problem is we don't know the true values, and so we have to use some kind of statistical estimator for this critical ratio. And Roy proved that a good estimate of that critical ratio, you can get it by calculating the objective function with k parameters estimated. So just from that nice curve, j versus the number of parameters, you pick off the one with the value for 17. You pick off the value for, we wanted the value for 56, but we couldn't get all the way to 56, so we say, well, the value at 44 is probably about the same as 56 because estimating more parameters wasn't helping us. So you can calculate this critical ratio. If it's less than 1, it's better to estimate only 17 rather than 56. And then we do some things, magic, with some Kubokawa estimators and things. And since no one likes non-central F distributions, I'll tell you, you calculate this corrected critical ratio, and the smallest value of that corrected critical ratio, the number of parameters that corresponds to that, is the best number to estimate to minimize this mean square error. So it's an optimization kind of problem, but we don't have to do any kind of iterative optimization to calculate that critical ratio, except for estimating the parameters and getting these objective function values for different numbers of parameters. Okay, so we found out it's possible, numerically possible, to estimate 44, but using that mean square error criterion, we should estimate 43. That's better than 44. But I must say that in other modeling studies, so I've been doing some expanded polystyrene models for BASF in Germany, and in that one, using the same analysis, it said only estimate 4 parameters out of 40, because there we had really good values, starting values for a lot of the parameters, and we didn't have very much new good data. In this nylon model, we had done a large number of good experiments, but we had only poor initial values for some of the parameters. And so the analysis said, use the data that you have to estimate nearly all of your parameters, 43 out of 56 of them. If you want to see, so here's some predictions from our model. This is just one of the six runs. And so you can see, during our experiments, the concentration of the amine ends went up. And the model is the smooth line in green. It goes up nicely. The carboxyl ends goes down. The BHMT branch points go up. And so you can see we're getting a nice match between the data and the predictions. And then here, the model also predicts these gaseous species. It says not much is happening to the cyclopentanone, the carbon dioxide evolution rates going up a little bit, but not much during the experiments. We only had two ammonia measurements. I don't know what happened to our ammonia measurements out here. They must have, something got lost or happened to the samples. But, you know, said not much is happening, not much is happening, so that was good. And if you look at all of our other plots, we get some nice results too. So, just a summary from this case study. We built a kinetic model that was a system of differential equations based on our chemical knowledge and assumptions about what happens in that reactor system. We had too many parameters. It had 56 unknown parameters and initial conditions, and we used this estimability ranking tool and mean square error criterion to decide which that we should estimate 43 parameters and which 43 we should estimate. All of the other ones got fixed at their initial values because those parameters either weren't important or we knew quite a lot about them already, and there wasn't enough new information in the data to justify estimating them. And the model can describe the data quite well. And so this model will be useful then for DuPont or its spin-off company, Invista, that they sold the Nylon business to, for selecting temperatures and moisture levels during the final stages of nylon production, so they can really use this model to make sure that they get high molecular weight polymer in short amounts of time without getting all of these degraded ends and problems. Also, we're going to use this model to test some more complicated parameter estimation techniques that we use. So we do some approximate maximum likelihood estimation techniques in future, and this is what I was talking about just a moment ago to one of the audience members. And so in the work that I showed you so far, we assume that the model equations are perfect and that the only problem is that we don't know the parameter values. In this work I'm talking about here, we say, well, the model's oversimplified, some of our simplifying assumptions aren't very good, and so there's some mismatch and there's some disturbances that are coming in while we're doing experiments. Let's take account of those things when you're doing the estimation, and we use some B-splines to kind of fit the data, fit some curves to the data, and then we have penalties, we have parts of our objective function that are deviations between the data and the model predictions, but also we look at the slope of the model predictions and how well they match these B-spline slopes. And for that work, because we would have 56 model parameters and then for each curve maybe 1,000 B-spline parameters, then we can get all kinds of nuisance parameters and lots of things that too many decision variables. And so there we use more complicated optimization tools. We use IPOPT. It's an interior point optimization technique from Larry Biegler's group at Carnegie Mellon. And we put the model equations in using AMPL. So I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with those tools. I mentioned Saeed Barziri's name and said we'd done some nylon 612 modeling. And we used these techniques for just a small modeling problem and published that work. And so it worked for a small problem. Now we're going to try it with our 14 differential equation, 56 parameter model, and see what happens when we try to do something more exciting. Okay, so just a few more words and then I'll finish up. So this estimability analysis, I used it to build this model and decide which parameters to estimate. But imagine, so in my lab, we've done these experiments, we build this model, and now imagine Keith wants to take that out and implement it in the plant at DuPont. And it kind of predicts, you know, the right qualitative behavior, but maybe he's getting some kind of mismatch and problems with it, and he doesn't like it very much. He gets some new industrial data. Then we can use it to figure out maybe three or four parameters in the model we could re-estimate using the industrial data and leave the other parameter values at home, values where they were based on the current estimation. So if you take a model, want to use it in a new situation and figure out which parameters need retuning, it's really good for that. Also, if we decided now that that Invista wanted to give us more money and do some more experiments, these are expensive experiments, do some more experiments, we can use that sensitivity matrix Z to think about new experiments that we might want to conduct. So we can do some de-optimal experimental design, and we can put additional rows. So let's say that I thought, well, maybe we should do these five particular experiments, and someone else said, no, I think these thought we should spend our money on five other experiments. We could put rows in the Z matrix corresponding to these different possible experiments, and then we could look at Z transpose Z, which is a Fisher information matrix, and then pick the experiments that are de-optimal, let's say. So we know how to do that, and I've had a student who did that with some polyethylene reactor modeling work. But that work, when you do de-optimal control, it just de-optimal experimental design, it just minimizes the joint confidence regions of the parameters that you pick to estimate. It doesn't take into account the bias and the parameters that you didn't estimate. So I have a new PhD student, and what I want her to work on is trying to select the experiments to do and which parameters you should estimate using the old experiments plus the new ones you add at the bottom to get the best possible, the lowest possible mean square error predictions from the model at the conditions that you're interested in. So to take into account the bias as well. So a few people to acknowledge. So I'd like to acknowledge Keith, who's in the audience. He's going to talk next, for all of the help with designing all of the experiments and the system and supporting Mark Schaefer's work. These are all chemical engineers, other professors at Queen's who've helped with developing some of the statistical tools for parameter ranking and the mean square error criterion. Graduate students and postdocs who've done really all of the work, and then financial support from MITAX and CERC, companies who've supported this work. And then so these are operating companies who need models, and then these are sort of statistics and control kinds of companies who are interested in model development technology. So in summary, then just to finish up, chemical engineers develop models, and then they want to use these models for optimizing industrial processes after they have the models. But there's quite a lot of optimization that takes place while you're trying to build the model in the first place. And if you have good physical understanding of what's going on, then you can write complicated equations and lots of tails about what's going on, and you can get a large number of unknown parameters, and estimating all those parameters is a difficult challenge. And you have to get the right balance between including all of the things and all of the phenomena in the model and making your model too complex so that it becomes unwieldy and hard to estimate all of the parameters. And so what I've been talking about today are some new techniques developed by my group to select which parameters to estimate in models, and then to determine how many you should estimate from the list. And then also just talked briefly about that these concepts are related to designing new experiments if you want to do some extra experiments. So that's it.